And we will endeavor to understand what has passed and imagine what is to come.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back. Now, here is your host, Millennial Woes.
Hello, and welcome back to Millennial 2025. This is the fourth night, and there are five streams tonight, four interviews. 2 hours from now, it'll be Endeavour, and then Debt Free Asferage, and then the McMullen. And then we'll have the Quarterway AMA, which is our new edition this year. But first of all, I'm here with Philip Dwyer. And if people could let me know if the volumes are okay, that would be useful. I'm not sure about mine. I'm not sure how it comes through. So, Philip, welcome to Millennial. This is your first time on the show. Could you briefly introduce yourself to the audience and tell them what you do and the background?
Yeah, Colin, thank you for inviting me on. It's an honor to be asked onto this prestigious show here, which I've seen it over the years, and fair play to you. You have great stamina to be able to do this. And it's great to be here. So it's kind of a bit surreal for me in a way to be actually sitting here talking to someone like you. Never in my wildest dreams would I have imagined that I could be sitting down on a podcast with someone like yourself. But it is what it is now. My name is Philip Dwyer. I have mainly a Twitter account, Facebook, and I try my best to do citizen journalism here in Ireland. Started back around 2019-2020. I ran in a couple of elections. I was a member of the National Party back in 2020. And we know, or you probably know, people like Keith Woods is involved in the National Party. And it's kind of taken off. It's when you realize, I suppose, back in the day, something happens to you, you're watching what's going on. I probably always had an inquisitive mind. And suddenly you see that there's no journalism out there. Journalists have disappeared off the face of the earth, proper journalists, but journalists who should be holding power to account. And I was kind of shocked, you know. It was like, we're in trouble here. We need something needs to be done about this. And the lies that were being told through the mainstream media it was shocking stuff. And I decided then, I was invited on after I got into the political scene, and I got invited on to a podcast with Critiqued, who was one of the OGs like yourself back in the day. And we started to do podcasts together. And then after that, then I started to make my own kind of, I branched out on my own, kind of doing outdoor stuff and live broadcasts outside. I would approach politicians and people who, you know, need to be approached and asked questions, who weren't being asked questions back in the day. And, you know, people tend to like that. They kind of said, yeah, it's great. Somebody's out there doing that. It's not happening in the mainstream. So the channel has grown from there. And the persecution and the cancellation and demonization as well has been outrageous, really. And it's not just me, it's lots of other people, and you're aware of that yourself. And the whole political scene in Ireland, it's gone from being corrupt in a sense of the money side of it, where they would be, you know, selling planning permission to developers for brown envelopes, which was, you know, we kind of all found out about. But we're at a stage now where the corruption has gone to a level where they're actually selling the whole country out demographically. They're destroying the country for, you know, our overlords in the EU and the UN and all these people, the bankers, people in control, let's call them. And it's destroying our country in front of our eyes. So here I am, I suppose. And it's something when you started, you can't really, you know, stop doing what you're doing. It's it's something that just has to be done. I feel it's kind of a duty thing as well. It's a voluntary thing mainly for me. People send me a few donations here and there, but it's something. It's so necessary now, and it's great. We were talking there a minute ago. The likes of Gran Torino, who was on earlier, would be one of the people who would have been one of my inspirations, and he's given me great help over the years as well, and advice. These guys were there at the start, so it's something that I probably don't want to be. I don't want to be here, Colin. You know, I'd rather be out playing golf a couple of times a week or having a few pints with the lads, but. The whole world has changed in such an unbelievable way that it not in my wildest dreams would have imagined, you know, that we'd be end up where we are. Like we have, you know, this transgender stuff going into schools and foisted on children. We have a school teacher here called Enoch Burke, who's in jail at the moment because he won't recognize or acknowledge or bow to transgenderism. And you have then the demographic change. You know, I can't walk outside my door here where I live. I suppose it's about 80% in my particular area is 80% is non-nationals, you know. So, and we have massive crime rates, you know, coinciding with the influx of migrants, similar to what's going on all over the Western Europe. So this is happening in little old Ireland, and it's just beggar's belief. I mean, I have friends, I mentioned in your notes there about the GAA, and my father was in the GAA, a hurling man. So my background is Gaelic games, you know, which goes back to 1884 when the Gaelic Association, Athletic Association was founded. And it's like it was founded as a kind of a rebel movement, like to promote Irish culture, Irish Gaelic games, and then to beat back against the crown and the British rule, I suppose. And it was a great recruiting ground for Irish rebels, you know, people like Michael Collins and Kevin Ball and Paul Pierce. Gaelic games was a big thing back then, but now even our Gaelic games have been infiltrated and taken over by the woke mind virus, the woke agenda, you know. So
right, everything, nothing seems to escape.
Yeah.
So 100%. There's a lot to pick up on there, but let's start with more about your own background and how you got to politically where you are today. I mean, would you say that in the 2000s, for example, you were a mainstream conservative sort of type or what?
Well, I mean, back in that time I was a postman, so I would have been a member of a trade union, you know, so I probably would have been left-leaning, you know, in that sense. But that's when kind of left-wing politics was kind of more it was more real. It was more based on looking after the working class, you know, whereas what I see now in unions and left wing, you know, they're all about refugees are welcome, you know, Ireland for all and yeah. Transgenderism, you know.
Yeah.
They've also
this is an amazing thing because the unions used to be a sort of pillar of no-nonsense, working class, common sense, very much about the economics and about protections for workers, very much the old left. But even they are now pillars of the wokery and the DEI and diversity. And it's really amazing because that's directly against the interests of the native working class, whom they're supposedly representing.
Yeah, and it's, I suppose you have to follow the money. I'm sure most of these unions are getting some kind of, you know, like the NGO class and industrial complex in Ireland, you know, it's massive. And I suppose trade unions would be classed as NGOs. And they're probably getting sponsorship to promote these DEI initiatives, you know. So, it's kind of, no matter where you turn in this country, I just say to people like, you know, Americans or whatever that come over, and a lot of Americans are pretty based, you know what I mean? People from outside the cities in America, you know, I've met a few along the way in the last year or two. They know what's going on, and call them Trump supporters. I would call them kind of, you know, constitutional, the American Constitution type of supporters. They love their Constitution and they believe in their Constitution. But these people know what's going on. And the trade union movement in Ireland, it's and Ireland itself, it's like California now at the moment. California on steroids, you know. It's all gone woke as can be. And it's, they don't know how to grasp it. Then these Americans that come over and they're like, they just can't believe it. Like, you know, what happened to us? So
they probably come over thinking they're going to see the Ireland of, you know, postcards and their grandparents' memories of the country and something quaint, something old fashioned, traditional, and instead they're confronted with, like California, but colder weather.
Yeah. I've actually made it my business. I've stopped once or twice in traffic driving along the quays in the city centre, and you can tell the American tourists. And, you know, I've often rolled down the window and stopped, and I'm saying, "How you doing?" And I say, can you show me, can you tell me, see any Irish people around?" You know, they look at me, you know, and then they kind of get it. They smile. And then I say, "Look, I apologize." And I literally apologize to them for the state of the way the city has gone, that you've come here and you're not getting Ireland like anymore. You're getting this multicultural hellhole, especially around Dublin city centre. Every town and village you go to now in Ireland, there's this, you know, huge demographic change going on. The country's not safe. It's, you know, it's the same in the UK. I'm sure most of your listeners know what I'm talking about. Europe, Paris, Brussels, Malmo, you know, Frankfurt.
And the thing is, and the weird thing is that diversity ends up producing the same everywhere. So diverse Dublin is very almost indistinguishable from diverse Stockholm, from diverse Berlin, etc. They're all the same because it's the same mad mix of all these different peoples who have nothing in common, and their native culture just gets swamped, completely swamped.
Mm. And what baffles me as well is that there's so many people still in Ireland and who'll vote for the government that are bringing in all these changes, all this demographic change. They're seeing it happen. They're seeing it happen in front of their eyes, and they're getting voted in again. They don't agree with it even, and it's just politically, as you said, I ran to politics. It's very difficult to formulate a policy or some kind of message that will get through to people. To make them understand that this is politics, like, to me now, it's more or less survival. You know, it's the life and death of the nation now, politics. And if we don't wake people up politically, we're all here, and I'm sure you're here. We're trying to not go to the place where we're going to have violence and, you know, civil war, let's say. And we've had a few very, very heated incidents over the last couple of years in Ireland now. Last couple of weeks there in City West, where a girl, a 10-year-old child, was allegedly raped. And that kicked off kind of unrest. So we're getting there. We're getting there slowly but surely. And it's like we've been trying to, I'm sure you have as well, been trying to warn the governments about the dangers of this, and yet we're labeled as, you know, we're the troublemakers, as let's call us, because we're talking about it. We're sending out the message. So I've just seen your I've seen your Wikipedia there the other day, and I was looking, we're very similar, and it's like you the way they describe you might as well have been, you know, at the door of the gas chambers bringing in these unfortunate people to help kill them. Like, that's, you know, you're a far right, you know, Nazi, whatever.
Because going by that and newspaper articles about me, you would think that I was just an absolutely awful person. And, you know, if I had more money, I would sue them. I would sue them for defamation. But this is part of the problem, that there's no question of doing that. And they know that I've got no ability to do that, and you haven't. So they're basically free to just paint us as the scum of the earth.
Yeah, I mean, look, don't lose hope on that. We've had a guy called John McGurk over here. I don't know if you've heard of him. He's the editor of Gripped Media here, which is a kind of I'd call them a pretend right-wing kind of media. They're kind of gatekeepers, in my opinion. But he was called far-right by some publication website in America, and he sued them in an Irish court, and he got €20,000 off them. So now he probably has the resources to take a case, but there's a precedent that has been set there in Ireland for that, you know. So let's see how that develops, you know. But as I said, you are a target. You are easy prey for them, and of course, my position, I kind of knew this was all going to happen anyway from the get-go. I'm sure you knew the same. But if we can't...
Honestly, I didn't. I was very naive. when I think about it now, I'm sort of embarrassed at how naive I was. But so in that sense, it wasn't brave. It was more foolhardy. I think for people who started later than me, they know for sure what's going to happen. And so there's a lot more bravery there explicitly. So let's get back to your development and your red pilling, if you like, because obviously a postman in the trade unions in the 2000s, that's not what people associate with what you're doing nowadays. So What was the first issue where you found yourself disagreeing with normal mainstream opinion? Can you remember? Was it mass immigration or something else?
No, it was 2016 when Trump got elected for the first time, and I was actually terrified, because to me he was portrayed as a, you know, an egomaniac, you know, somebody that just loved himself and God knows what he was liable to do. And this was according to the mainstream media. But like, as I said, I've said this publicly anyway, I have three sons who are grown up now, but they actually red-pilled me. They actually led me to look at alternative media and stop listening to RTE, you know, American news, CNN, you know, ABC, MSNBC, all these propaganda merchants. And they kind of said, just check this out, Dan. What they're saying about Trump is all lies and everything else. So once you start that, you go on that road, it's unbelievable when you see what the amount of misinformation that they're putting out, the how it's being all directed towards one globalist agenda. And RTE in Ireland is our main channel in Ireland. They're probably one of the worst on the planet for propaganda, you know, anti-Irish and globalist propaganda. And so it was a quick enough transition into the real world. And then people like yourself would have been around back then. People like Gran Torino, Dave Cullen, Computing Forever. So there were the people that I would start to listen to, you know. And it was like, it was just... unbelievable that you felt that your country, because back in the day when I was younger, like we had a wonderful time, like from say the late 80s up to the 2000, 2005, 2006, Ireland, like when I say economically, we had a wonderful time. It didn't make us nicer people back then. You know, we went from being, unemployment was at 18, 20% when I left school, 1985. But the funny thing was, when we all started out socializing, the pubs were full, you know, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. Don't know why the pubs were full. Maybe there was no mortgages. There wasn't as many people up to their eyeballs in debt, maybe. But it was a massive social scene back then. And then we had Euro 88, the first time Ireland qualified. There was great national pride there as well for that. Irish fans went over to Stuttgart or to Germany, and the whole world saw how we were able to conduct ourselves at matches, like just enjoy ourselves. There was no hooliganism, or, you know, whereas the English and the Dutch would be fighting, or the English, the Poles would be fighting. The Irish just went over, started hugging the police and having the crack. I think that spurred on something as regards the economic growth as well. We had qualified for the World Cup in 1990. It was the same thing. So there was this, you know, upsurge in self-belief, I suppose, in the Irish psyche. You know, we said, look at us, we're out there, we're loved by everyone. We're able to go out and enjoy ourselves and show people how it's done. And then investment started to come into Ireland, and money started to come in. And then we all started to become property millionaires. The prices of our properties went up. And that didn't make us nicer people. It actually made us, you know, this uppity, arrogant, you know, looking down our noses at each other. I've got two houses and a holiday home in Spain or whatever. And we were going to nice restaurants and spending money on, you know, Brown Thomas's and clothes and stuff like that. And that went from the 90s into the 2000s. And there was a huge amount of property development. And then we had an influx around the 2000s of Eastern European workers and stuff like that to build all these new properties. And then
was that about 2004, 2005?
Yeah, well, around that time, yeah, the population of Ireland was like, I think, 2 to 3% non-national around 2002, 2003. So it's now at about anywhere between 25 to 30%. And that's only in 20 odd years, like 22 years. So that demographic change is absolutely unheard of, unprecedented. So yeah, that was the start of it. And you know, it's funny how the Eastern Europeans that you meet nowadays, I mean, most of them are awake to what's going on. They understand tyranny. And we're living in it now. So Ireland, yeah, it was a great place back then as regards. We didn't know what was going on. We just thought, oh, look, it's our time now. Ireland has suffered for 800 years. We've been persecuted and we've been tormented. We've been ruled over by the English. We've had our so-called, you know, our Holocaust, our they called the famine, you know, where we were starved to death. And we millions left, millions died or whatever. So this is our time, like back in the day. We've come now to fruition as a nation. But it wasn't really. It was kind of fake. It was fake money. It was money from Germany, you know, cheap interest rates and stuff like that, you know. But at the same time, we enjoyed ourselves. We socially and everything else, we, you know, there'd be golf outings, we'd be going to expensive golf clubs, you know, not the old Kip down the road or the Pitch and Putt Club down the road. And lads were getting into building houses and they were making plenty of money and you know, things were good. But socially, we were all, ethnically Irish, you know, and we were all, you know, just, there was great social cohesion going on. And then all of a sudden, we wake up. It's like I woke up one day, back around mid-2015, 2016, like, and you start to look around you and you walk through your city and then all of a sudden it's like, what's going on here? Like, there's a lot of non-Irish people around the place. Like, there's the schools now are talking about 60 different genders, telling children there's gay pride marches for a month. You know, there's gay flags going up for a whole month, you know, where, you know, we Paddy's Day, St. Patrick's Day is one day, you know. So when you suddenly look at all that, you know, as a part of your awakening, something has gone terribly wrong. And it's like they comatosed us. They put us to sleep for, you know, 15 odd years in Ireland, I think. But, you know,
with prosperity.
Prosperity, yeah. That's probably the best word for it, yeah. But it was a fake prosperity, really. And then we had our crash and our austerity. And then we're kind of falling back into the same trap again. There's a lot of kind of positive things happening with the economy as regards building houses and stuff like that. And there's plenty of employment out there, like, you know. And we can't fill the jobs, so we're bringing in all these migrants. And that's one of their excuses, as well as the fact that there's a refugee crisis going on around the world. But it's Ireland is in, like, I've done a few podcasts now talking to people from abroad, and it's like I say to them, Ireland is in big trouble. Like, it's just, we need help. We need, you know, we are doing good work here. We're making progress. It has to be said. But you know, as I said, we're like California. We're the last in the class. We're Paddy last in the class to kind of wake up as a population. You know, but we are doing okay. There's a lot more people out there. As GT's Gran Torino said the other night, there's a lot more people out there now making content, quality kind of people, journalists now doing work. You know, some of them I have reservations about, you know, but by and large, the message is getting out there. And Joe Normy now, everybody knows there's too much migration. They're starting to see the likes of teachers being locked up for over the transgender issue, and they're not happy about it. But how that kind of transcends into voting this tyrannical government out, I don't know. Just looking at the likes of Bulgaria there now, which I know very little about, but we've seen that they've been able to amass such a crowd in the main city there that the government now has resigned. You know, we haven't been able to. We've got there to about 50,000 we've gotten them out on the street, but we need, you know, 400,000 or 500,000 to get a similar result. And that's not, I suppose, it's when you think of it, if it can be done in Bulgaria, it can be done in the UK, and it can be done in Ireland. So it's something, you still have to maintain hope, Colin, you know?
Oh, definitely, definitely. So let's talk about the state of journalism, and then we'll get to what you do, citizen journalism. John Waters has made this point as well. He's been on Millennial quite a few times, and he's going to be on again this year as well. And he's made this point that he was a journalist. He was part of the mainstream media. And he realized at a certain point that they were just paid liars now. And whatever the job was, profession was, that he had joined and thought that he was joining, that had gone away. And really, they were just propagandists. At what point did you make that realization? Was that when you saw how Trump was being talked about and when your sons told you that that wasn't the case?
Yeah, I think you can single, I remember what John said about that. I think he can single it down to one moment, I think, when he was in a car being driven somewhere by a colleague of his. And it was something to do with some article that he had been writing. And whatever I think this guy had said to him driving the car, he said, oh, John, you can't say that. You know, you can't, you know, it must have been his boss or something like that. And I think he turned around to him and he said, that's grand. Listen, pull over there. And I think he got out of the car and he says, I won't be working for you anymore or whatever, you know. That was his moment when he said, enough is enough. That's it, you know. So I suppose I didn't consciously get into journalism myself until a few years after, you know, the initial red pilling, as they call it, an awakening where, you know, you saw Trump 2016. And then when you looked into what Trump was about, then there was this relief. It's like, Jesus, he's not that bad. At least he's a businessman. He's working off figures and common sense kind of thing, you know, 2 + 2 = 4 kind of thing. And then you're kind of looking at the mainstream in Ireland and how, you know, unbelievably corrupt they are. I kind of just drifted towards it with the podcast. And before I knew it, I was doing this stuff out in the street. If I came across some bizarre incident, I used to do a lot of driving in my jobs that I was in before I became unemployable. But it was like, if I was going around the city, I'd stop and something bizarre would be happening that I would like to expose. And I'd just go out and put people on camera. If I saw politicians out in the street, I'd go out and confront them. If I saw a mainstream news crew filming on the street, you know, I'd walk out and I'd interrupt them and I'd say, you know, why aren't you covering A, B, or C? Or, you know, just trying to, you know, let them know that we're here and there's a new media coming on. There's new people coming in here that are not going to let you away with this. And we're going to question you. We're going to question you publicly and expose you. So, it drifted that way. And then I was on YouTube. So, and then, of course, I got banned.
Well, we'll get to that. So it sounds like it just started almost back, like there was no grand plan. You were just out and about and you thought, well, I'll film this. I'll film that. And I guess because you had was that a smartphone or was that a dedicated camera? What was it that you were using?
Just a smartphone, Colin. And like I said, it was kind of always mostly impromptu. And it was like, but people liked it. You know what I mean? It became popular.
Yeah.
And I used to have YouTube. I had it was mainly YouTube. And that was the thing, when YouTube was taken off me, it was a bit of a blow, but still and all, you move on.
How long had you been going by the time that happened?
I'd say about two and a half years, I suppose, on YouTube. Then some of my streams, I would live stream protests and stuff like that. I live streamed the events in Dublin when the three children were stabbed in Parnell Square, the three cool kids were stabbed. That was huge. I think when I was live, there was 100,000 people in my live stream when during that, got badly beaten up. But as soon as I started to make an impression, then the kind of the persecution started from the system, that the authorities started kind of, they're coming after me, like, and you know, censorship and arrests and, you know, guards watching you, like, and they have files on us now and stuff like that. We're kind of treated like domestic terrorists because we're, you know, politically active against the regime, let's call it. And it's really blatant, like, you know, it's blatant in the UK as well. I mean, it's probably worse for you guys over there because they're locking a lot more people up over social media posts over there. They're starting to do it here now, you know, as well.
Yeah. I mean, God knows what my MI5 file says. I can't imagine. It'd be interesting to know exactly when they opened it as well. I wonder how many subscribers on YouTube did I need to have before something was triggered and they, right, okay, we'll create a file on this guy. It would be interesting to know that. But so you were banned on YouTube, and then after that, the authorities started coming after you, or when? I'm interested just to piece together, like, was it Silicon Valley who censored you first, or was it the Irish state who attacked you first?
I think it was Silicon Valley. I think Twitter probably were the first people to ban me, and then YouTube, I think. So, it was definitely social media companies started to ban first, and then Garda, so things started to happen, you know, because Ireland is such a small country, and you can't, you know, you can't call out the corruption of the police here without repercussions. Like, there's going to be definite repercussions. So, and then on top of that, like, you have politicians that are able to sit in the parliament and associate you with, say the Dublin riots that happened in 23 with the children being stabbed. It was like, well, I was named as one of the people like that turned up. I turned up to cover the news and live stream it, but I was associated with causing them, you know. And then there was four or five other lads named in the parliament to say that these turned up, and then all of a sudden trouble kicked off. And it was like, well, I've never condoned violence. I'd make it my business to, you know, talk about people not get involved in violence. It's counterproductive. Like, it's what they want you to do. It gives them an excuse to introduce more draconian measures against people. So I've always advocated against violence, but this is it. They're looking for a bogeyman. They're looking for people to blame when it's really themselves and their policies that are causing these problems, this trouble and unrest. So, and then guards would come after you. I got badly beaten that night the night of the riots in 23. I mean, I was deliberately singled out by an inspector. And, you know, so it's not just a rank and file guard. He knew, he probably read a file on me well long before that. I was standing there I got caught up in a charge by the public order unit. And I wanted to go away from the trouble in another direction. But anyway, it all worked against me. And this particular inspector just unleashed about 10 blows as hard as he could on my legs. So he knew exactly. He was delighted to have the opportunity to do this. I had a camera and a microphone, a big microphone in my hand, and I was just live streaming. So there was no excuse for him that I wasn't a rioter. I wasn't setting anything on fire. I wasn't throwing any stones, anything like that. And he knows when these troubles start, they have the excuse now to attack whoever they want. And the same thing happened in City West to the GB News guy, Doogie. There was a couple of Ezra Levant was there. They got caught up
Ah, yes.
At the front. I don't know listeners might remember that, but they were caught up. I had stayed back because I have learned my lesson. When these things happen, you keep your distance from them because they are absolutely ruthless. They've been told that a 55-year-old woman was brutally assaulted and arrested trying to get back to her car by these guys, which, and they know full well these people aren't cause of trouble, but they attacked the journalists that were there that night in City West after the 10-year-old child was allegedly raped. So the Irish police are out of control as far as I'm concerned, and if you keep talking about that, they will target you, they will come after you. The next day after the riots or the trouble in City West, I went back to do a stream, kind of the day after the night before was the title of it. Walked back down to the entrance of the hotel and I got surrounded by guards, and they took all my equipment off me and said it was my video camera, whatever, were in part of an investigation to a van being burned, that they thought I had filmed this van, which I hadn't. I'd been live streaming, so nothing gets recorded on your phone when you're live streaming. It's up there on the World Wide Web. Anything that they can see is there for them to see without having to take equipment. So, and they took my microphone and my gimbal, which won't tell them anything about a van being burnt, and it was just, you know, an attack. It was an attack on my ability to do my work. So, yeah, the police in Ireland, out of control, a very close-knit shop. Because we're such a small country, a lot of them can... They've been given a license now to deal with the far right whatever way they can. And it's...
They'll call you far right. You're far right just for talking about this, just for reporting it. You don't need to actually do anything.
Yeah, well, I was arrested last year for the Coolock. There was trouble in Coolock, and that's in the north side of Dublin, where they were putting the Rec Provision Centre into a paint factory. You know, in the middle of a working class area, the people were adamant it wasn't going in, and not that.
You should maybe explain what a Direct Provision Centre is, just for people who don't know.
Well, what we have in Ireland now is we call them Direct Provision Centres, where they bring in these so-called asylum seekers, and they house them, and it's like practically in Ireland, it's anywhere nearly with a roof on it. Sometimes they put them into fields with tents, army tents, and it's absolutely ridiculous. And we're in so many towns and villages now in Ireland, like you're talking about hundreds of towns and villages around Ireland now have been affected, and these direct provision centres have been installed. And most of them are military age men coming from Middle East, Africa, no documents or whatever. And it's a frightening prospect for these areas. And already there's been lots of trouble, you know, sexual assaults, rapes, murders, internal riots in these places. So, yeah, this direct provision center was proposed, and it was going to house 900 or something like that, military age men. And so the locals weren't having it. And then there was a bit of trouble kicked off. I went to it, live streamed it. I was approached by another inspector, you know, and he had a body cam on him. It was outside the McDonald's, well back from the entrance to this factory or whatever that they were proposing to put this place. And I asked him, you know, can you explain to us what's going on, inspector, whatever? And he kind of, within 30 seconds, I was arrested. I was asked to leave the area, but I was like, well, I'm a journalist or whatever, blah, blah, blah. But within 30 seconds, you're under arrest, had me in cuffs or whatever, into the back of a van. So I'm appealing that. But he had written in his statement for the case that I was known to him as a far-right agitator. So that's what the memos are coming down from high up, you know, that he's not a citizen. Even though I've been in court and judges have, I've appealed the bail conditions for that case, and the judge rescinded the bail conditions, and he did acknowledge that I was a citizen journalist, and citizen journalists have same rights as any other journalist, and even protected under European law. So, but yet, as far as he was concerned, this inspector guy, He said, yeah, he's a far-right agitator, and I don't even know what that means. He doesn't even know what it means, and I don't think the judge knows what it means, but we'll be bringing it up on the next day on the appeal anyway, and he'll have to explain himself. The same inspector, Colin, is a diversity officer. I don't know if you have them in the UK. We've got about 400 of them in the Irish police force, checking, you know, mean words on the internet. And he probably is told as well that there's 72 genders, and anyone who says otherwise is potentially a criminal. So
definitely a far-right agitator.
Yeah, that's it. I mean, is it a badge of honor? But I'd love him to explain what he means by that, you know. But at the same time, it is kind of it's dangerous for people, because, you know, it's for people like myself and yourself. The reality is, the harsh reality is that what they're really trying to do is to inspire people to attack you. You know, they're trying to get some far left maniac to see you on the road and just, you know, think that he's after meeting Adolf Hitler and he wants to attack. And it's happened to me a couple of times. I have a case going on at the moment. I'm prosecuting a guy who just literally ran after me, and, you know, he attacked me, had to stand me ground or whatever, and he went off. But he's a well-known left-wing activist, and a vicious in that. He was the most vicious attack that I've had so far, but totally inspired by these people calling you these names. He actually said, "I love Israel," which nothing could be further from the truth. Like, it's like, you know, it's like that's how misinformed he is, you know, about who you are or what you stand for, you know. But in his frenzy, you know.
Yeah. Antifa are simply the attack dogs of the regime, and they're used in that way, and they're pushed, they're encouraged to do things to us, and then the system covers up for them. The media will defend them, the judiciary will let them off, and it's sickening how obvious all of this is, how in your face it is, that yeah, we're using these people to beat you up so that you will just go away, so that you'll stop. And until you do, we'll keep using these people to beat you up or intimidate you or whatever. It's so out in the open, you know, because you think, well, we live in a modern democracy and all this, mm-hmm. this kind of thing doesn't happen. The system, the government, the state would never do something like that. But it does, and there's no shame about it. There doesn't seem to be any, because there's the media doesn't hold them to account.
Correct. And we've had a political party, like I mentioned, the National Party earlier. I used to be a member. I'm no longer a member there. But was it 2 years ago, they had their annual meeting. It's called the Ardesh. And they had it in a hotel in Enniskillen. And somebody obviously... there was somebody found out that it was being held there, and a group of Antifa arrived in a bus, you know, 30 or 40 of them. A lot of them had hammers and axes and things like that, and they attacked them. And this is a registered political party that runs candidates and stuff like that, engaged in the democratic process. And the next thing, we didn't hear a word from the media. We didn't, maybe a tiny piece from the media, but now nobody from the political class came out and said, this is an attack on democracy. Like, this is an attack on a legitimate registered political party. You know, there was one lad had a very bad hand injury after it all. There was one guy prosecuted. I still haven't heard the result of that prosecution, out of a busload of 30 to 40 people that arrived at this hotel and ran amok. So it's violence against the right wing in Ireland is legitimate as far as the regime is concerned, as the establishment is concerned. And you do have the likes. We've got a TD, a member of parliament in Ireland called Paul Murphy. He's a left wing, people before profit, they call him. Total communist. He's had a child recently, a boy, and made it into the mainstream. The Irish Times did a big article about how he's going to allow his child to choose his own gender. He called the child Juniper. So that were, and since that, he got re-elected into Parliament, right, since he did that. So that's how insidious and evil, and this is the guy who's naming our names in the Parliament under Dáil privilege, under parliamentary privilege, and he's associating us with riots, and then he's associating us with buildings being burnt down, direct provision centres being burnt down. A few of them have been burnt down. Never once have I ever condoned any of that activity. I've always condemned it and disassociated myself with anything like that. And but he seems to want to associate the likes of us because he knows that there will be repercussions, that if somebody, some lunatic on the left, decides that he wants to get violent. And I've had death threats. I've had, you know, malicious phone calls, you know, saying that I had my hand on the, I had my finger with, ready to go and pull the trigger or whatever when I was near you. You don't know who I am kind of stuff, you know. You know, and most of these people just talk garbage and reported them to police, by the way, knowing full well they will do nothing for you. And none of them ever did. But when there was, if there's a TD or a member of parliament, recently our Tánaiste, which is our deputy prime minister, was allegedly threatened online by somebody. They had this guy in custody within 24 hours, whoever this account was online. But if the likes of myself or even yourself, Colin, gets a death threat like that, nothing is done about it. Like, it's not important to them, you know. So it's definitely gone really downhill in Ireland. And it's, I know the figures for arrests for people in the UK over social media posts is something like 12,000 last year or something in the UK, or this year in the UK, you know, which is like,
Russia, it rings a bell.
Russia has 300 or 400, you know, and it's, you know, UK has become a dangerous place for any dissenting voices by the sound of things. Like, I suppose all of the West is, but the UK in particular. But
Under Starmer, this Labour government, but it was bad before them as well. I mean, we shouldn't blame it on them. I think that's a mistake. The British state is quite, well, as the Irish know, the British state can be very ruthless and brutal when it wants to be. About your equipment being seized, did you ever get it back?
No, I don't intend to get, I don't expect to get it back to in the near future, but I've put in a complaint to the Garda, you know, ombudsman or whatever you want to call him, and I reported the individual guard who removed my stuff. He seemed to be very enthusiastic about the way he was approaching me with this. You know, it was like there was a memo sent down. If any of these people like Dwyer show up, take their equipment. You know, doesn't matter legally or illegally. Doesn't matter how legal. So, and the same individual made himself his, because this went viral when I put up the video of him taking my equipment. He had been viral the previous year for going into a shop. He was filmed going into a shop where some young lad was attempting to rob the place. Now, the video footage shows the young fella wasn't doing really any damage to the shop. He was in there unlawfully and all that, but he looked like a teenager, maybe 16, 17 years of age. His hood was up, it was covered. And this guy went in and he pepper sprayed him and he brutally beat him with a baton. And the guy wasn't putting up any resistance, you know. So, a guy who was he's very enthusiastic about his job, probably not suited to the job itself by the way he treated that young fella and by the way he was just willing to remove. And I went to the police station afterwards, and I went to the reception, asked to speak to the sergeant to see would he give me like even my gimbal back or my microphone back, and they just treated me with contempt. And I just said, look, I'll give you a fair warning on this. Anyone who's involved in stealing my property, I'll be taking it further. I'll be taking it to the courts, because I'm a journalist and it's actually a more serious matter to take devices off a journalist. And whether they think I'm a journalist or not, that's irrelevant. The European courts have ruled on it that citizen journalists are equally as entitled to the privileges that journalists get. Like, they have to have a court order to get into my phone You know, they have to get a judge to make an order on it and let them do it. So I'm sure they haven't even done that because they don't regard me as a journalist. I'm a far-right agitator in their eyes. And even, hilariously, the woman who got arrested, I mentioned her earlier, she's 55 years of age, and she got in touch with me, reached out, told me her story, and it was absolutely horrific what they did to her. Like, she said they put the pepper spray about an inch from her eyes and sprayed her straight into the eyes. Like, this is a 55-year-old woman. You're not talking about a 22-year-old tug, you know, a violent tug. This woman, she was simply asking to get to her car. She just wanted to go home. She didn't want to be part of it. She came here to peacefully protest. She didn't want to be part of any violence. They bent her up, arrested her in a cell, and then a female policewoman started to speak to her when she was in the police station. And one of the first things she asked her was, did she know me? Did she know Philip Dwyer? And she said, well, I know of him. Yeah, Philip Dwyer. And the policewoman says, yeah, he's an awful troublemaker, isn't he? So, in other words, in her head and in whatever way they're indoctrinating these guards is that they're trying to focus the blame on someone like me for causing this trouble, as if, you know, that the woman or the poor child that got raped by allegedly by a migrant, an illegal migrant who had a deportation order since last March, shouldn't have been even in the country. But they want to focus on the likes of me being a troublemaker for highlighting this. Did I encourage people to protest? Absolutely. I always encourage people to get out and exercise their right to protest. That's not illegal. But at the same time, I report on stuff. But it's the reporter, it's the messenger. They're the troublemakers. They're the problem. It's not the fact that the police themselves are allowing our borders to be invaded, where they have the legal right to stop these people. There's immigration laws there that shouldn't be subject to political policy. You know, they shouldn't be a part of a political party's ideology of mass migration. The laws on migration are there, and if you haven't got your papers and your documents, you're sent back, you know. But we're not doing this in Ireland. So the police are partly to blame as well. But they want to deflect that or project that blame onto people like myself and you know, people like yourself, Colin, who talk about this stuff, you know.
It's part of the system that it has to deal with people who create trouble for it. And I think a big way that they do that is just to make your life difficult and unpleasant. And part of that is taking your equipment away. Have they ever raided your house?
No, not yet. I was expecting it. And this is another insidious side to the police here in Ireland as well. When I was contacted by the mother of the child, the young 10-year-old child who was allegedly raped at that hotel, at that direct provision center. It's called City West Hotel. I didn't tell your viewers. It's the biggest hotel in Ireland, which has now been bought over by the government and turned into a massive hub for direct provision of asylum, so-called asylum seekers and refugees. But this child, she was under the care of the state when she went missing, and she ended up at the entrance to this hotel and allegedly raped by this asylum seeker. He's up on charges, an African asylum seeker who was supposed to be deported last March. That grandmother reached out to me. I went and I met her, and we did an interview, and she's a very vulnerable woman, very upset. She didn't get into any kind of condemnation of anybody, like in her family, or because it's a broken family, or even the authorities. She didn't really get into what she wanted was to get to see her grandchild again. She just wanted, you know, supervised visits, whatever it takes, just to see her grandchild. She said that her grandchild is her side of the family are the ones that she is most in tune with, or she has the closest relationships with, and all she said was, I just want to see her and tell her we love her and hug her. She was very, it was a very upsetting interview, now I have to say, one of the most upsetting ones I did. And then I put it up online, and within an hour of that going up online, she got a phone call from the police to say that she will be under investigation now because she might have jeopardized the trial. for the case, and she's very vulnerable person, like, and then there's probably family issues. So the next day we spoke about it, and other people in the family asked me to take it down, the video down. Now I wouldn't do that unless the grandmother herself, who did the interview, wanted me to take it down. And we spoke the next day, and she just said, "Phil, this is too much for me. Will you take it down?" And I took it down then. And at that stage, it had got 100,000 views on Facebook, so it was out there. But it was, I had to go by her wishes. You know, she had every right to ask me to take it down, and so I did. But the police and this woman was so. She knew she was dealing with a vulnerable person. Like, they didn't ask me. They didn't ring me and ask me to take it down. I would have probably had the ability to deal with this female policewoman. But this, she kind of just terrified the poor woman and said, "Well, we're going to be investigating you now, and you could be." And she's like, "Why am I in trouble? I didn't say anything bad. I didn't say anything against anyone in it. I just want to see my granddaughter." "Well, we're going to have to see it. I haven't seen the video myself, but there are people now. They're going to go through it, and we'll be back on to you. We'll be ringing you back, you know." And I thought that to me is really insidious. I mean, as if the woman hadn't been through enough, you know.
Absolutely
distraught about her grandchild.
For in a situation like that, the woman has never been through something like that before. I don't mean the alleged rape. I mean the police treatment offered. It's new to her, but for the police, they're experts at this. They've done it 100 times before, so they know what they're doing. She doesn't know what's going on, so. They have an automatic upper hand just because it's like the thing about the sociopath. Each of his victims might never have been victimized by a sociopath before. So they're new to it. They don't know what's going on. But the sociopath has got 1,000 victims throughout his life. He knows exactly how to manipulate. And I think it's a similar thing with the police, where they've got a lot of experience in intimidating people. And controlling them, getting them to do what they want, and so I don't know what to say about that. It's just,
well, it's become
reprehensible.
Yeah, it's become par for the course. I feel it's these things. You know, it's very hard to get concrete evidence on this, but it's more mainly anecdotal. Where you, even the families of the three children who were stabbed in Parnell Square, which was worldwide news and everything else. Nobody knows who these families are. Nobody knows the parents or who these children are, you know. And as far as I know, they have been told by the police not to speak to anybody about this. This is a sub judice or whatever. They're not allowed because it's a migrant after committing the crime. And then you have the other crimes that people are affected by migrants. It's like the first thing they're told, and it's like par for the course now in the police doctrine, is to tell these victims that no, you can't speak about this migrant after committing this crime, because you'll jeopardize the case, or you'll get yourself, you could be prosecuted yourself for contempt of court and all of this. And it's like this bully. And even there was a guy in Dublin last year who it's a place called Stony Batter, North Inner City, Dublin, walked into an area, knocked on doors. I think he knocked on 3 separate doors with a Stanley knife in his hand, and he slashed 3 people that came out to the front door. And he was claiming mental health. I think he was Brazilian. I went into the courtroom that for his case, and suddenly there was a bit of a, you know, the guards were, and the judge, something was said, the guards were looking around him. Probably saw the likes of me there and said, right, everybody clear the courtroom. So I got to see this guy, but they were straight over to me. And there was a sergeant came straight to me and put his hands on me to pull me out of the courtroom. Not ask me to leave, put his hands right out. You know, they don't want this migrant crime to be reported on, you know. And it's like they're putting, it's like putting a plaster on a gaping wound, you know, that. They think this is going to help, this is going to solve it. But the reality is, when it comes to a head, there's going to be more attacks. There's going to be something similar now to what happened, God help them, in Bondi Beach there yesterday. It's like, we're going to get that here, and there's going to be huge, huge problems, and there's going to be violence. And if they would only, you know, change their tack, come to their senses, you know, and start to re-migrate these people, start to do the sensible thing. There's hope to save us from that horrible situation in the future. I don't want my kids and grandkids to have to be involved in a society that turns into violence and turmoil, you know, and a South Africa kind of scenario, I think you could call it. So but they're just not listening. And it's very disheartening with the police, the guards as well, because it's been such a small country. I mean, I grew up with lads and played sport with lads, hurling and football, Gaelic football, soccer with members of the police, and who were lads that were hardy fellas, you know, straightforward, common sense, afraid of nothing. And now look what we have as a police force. We have this, these malleable, useful idiots, I suppose you could call them, brainwashed, indoctrinated, the ones that are younger and coming out of colleges now, you know, completely indoctrinated with wokeness, and it's just frightening. It's not good. And they're none of them, a lot of people on our side, like let's say the right and the awake or whatever, they still have this kind of faith that the guards will come around one day. They will suddenly say no more of this or whatever. But I've yet to meet any guard, really. There was one or two. Good guy called John Wilson, who's over here. He's doing broadcasts now. He's speaking out. But overall, I haven't been approached by any member of the guard. One guy approached me in the courts. I won't say much about it. And he's watching my stuff, he says, and I admire him. And he says he's operating in clown world. That's the phraseology he used. He said, Phil, I was watching your stream last night, whatever, fair play to you. And I was really suspicious of him and says, oh, what do you want me for? And he says, oh, no, I was watching your stream, fair play to you. He said, it's clown world where I'm operating in. And which was encouraging to hear, but he was the one out of, what, thousands? And then I've seen them at incidents of trouble. Newtown Mem Kennedy last year, where a sleepy Irish village in County Wicklow they put in a direct provision centre close to the village. The people didn't want it. They made a peaceful protest. Next thing we had public order units in there. And then I was there streaming for most of the day. I had to go. I was running out of power. And there was guys leaning over the wall saying, police, you know, ordinary police leaning over the wall. And I'll never forget this guy, and he was trying to be so nice to the locals. He said, like, I understand where you're coming from, guys, I really do, but we're just giving our orders and we're giving instructions, and you know what I mean, I really kind of sympathize with where you're coming from, you know. So when I left half an hour later, I watched the live stream. Someone else, the same individual, had his baton out and he was smacking people over the head with it, you know. So unfortunately, I can't trust any of them anymore. I would love to be wrong. I would love that. I wish I could, but I just don't trust any of them. They will just do what they're told, end of, and that's it.
Yeah. This is a strange aspect of it, because especially in a small country like Ireland, and it would be the same in Scotland, the police is not some foreign force, I was going to say. It's not a bunch of aliens. It's people who are known to the general public. It's their cousins, their brothers, their school friends, etc. And so you'd think that there would be a sense of commitment and moral duty to the public within the police. But it seems like there isn't. There's more just utter contempt for the public.
Yeah. And I'll call him a policeman, did say to me once that, Phil, there's so many of them now that are kind of trapped with mortgages and rent, and they're so dependent financially. And a lot of it is that they are getting paid a lot of money now on overtime. There's unlimited overtime now in the Irish police. So they're actually able to double and triple their wages, you know, and they're able to, a lot of them are probably, investing money and stuff as well, doing it out of greed. But a lot of them are caught in the rat race, like, you know what I mean, they're debt slaves, like most people now. But still, like, where do you draw the line? What would it take for you? You're asked to go out and beat down your own people with batons. I've said it to them off camera. I've walked along a line of them off camera. So, guys, you understand what you're doing. You're bringing us down this dark road. Like, it's a dark, dark road you're bringing us, your own people. This should not be happening. We shouldn't be here. I don't want to be here. You shouldn't have to be here. When are we going to do something about this? What do you talk about when you go back to the police station? I'd say to them, you know, would you not look each other in the, when you go back, have a private word with each other, talk to each other, and just do something. You do not have to obey illegal instructions or orders, you know. It'll take, you know, a couple of them maybe. And then if it does start something off, some kind of a mass awakening among the police, it'd be wonderful. But I just right now, I just can't see it. They're just so dumbed down, a lot of them, you know.
Yeah, yeah. What would you say to anyone who was considering becoming a citizen journalist themselves and following in your footsteps? What advice would you offer someone? Because I don't want the, I mean, we've talked here about the hazards of it and the suffering imposed on you especially. Would you say that it's something that people should avoid doing? Or do you think that, well, what are the dangers, basically?
Well, the first thing I'd say probably is to get rid of your assets. Get your assets out of your name. Put them into someone else's name where you can't be. If you have any personal wealth, you know, remove it so they can't get at that. I would say... Be courteous all the time, as courteous as you can. People might regard me on our side as being a bit kind of forceful or kind of in your face kind of stuff. I would say no, I just don't back down. I get threats and intimidation when I'm out with the microphone talking to people. I don't back down. Sometimes it doesn't work out, but 99% of the time, 98%, it does work out. So I would always be civilized. You're asking me to do what I do, go out and about, approach anybody who disagrees with you and give them the mic time, give them the time to even abuse you, call you names or whatever. And just it's a way of showing the ordinary person how messed up people on the left are. And when I finish them, I usually say, like, these people represent your government policies. These people are supporting your government. So yeah, it's kind of, you really have to make a decision for yourself right now in Ireland, if you're going to do citizen journalism, that be prepared for the worst, be prepared to be locked up, and be prepared to be, take a few slaps. I've taken a few, and I've always known, and I've a hurling background. I mean, have you ever seen hurling being played or whatever? You know, a few slaps to me isn't, you know, a lot of people who get hurt like that mightn't be able for it. I'm kind of able for that side of it. I'm able for the abuse. I don't know why. I says, well, we didn't talk about families, but I've had a rough say childhood and you know, the traumas that a lot of people have, I've survived them all. It's probably given me the ability to endure a lot more abuse than a lot of people would. It's water off a duck's back, I suppose, in that sense. But you definitely need to have a steely resolve, I suppose, in Ireland right now. And it's psychologically, it's very satisfying, you know, as well. I mean, it does, I can leave this earth, Colin, and I can say to myself, you know, before I go, well, I try to do something for my people and for, you know, some good. And I feel that. And then it's the support you get to. And when you go out and about on the street, people come up and thank you and say thanks and everything else. So there is the nice side of it as well. But you really have to understand that if you're going to go out and about in Ireland today, that there is a lot of nasty people out there. We thought we were living, as I said, back in the 2000s, we thought we were all living in this idyllic world. We were all making a few quid. We were socializing. We used to have great crack, great nights out. You know, be very little argy bargy or anything like that. And then when all this COVID stuff and all this division kicked in, you can see the people, what they're really like, you know, when it comes to the crunch. How many people during the COVID scam would have put you on a freight train and shipped you off to a camp somewhere and say, yeah, well, it's your own fault. You didn't take the jabs, or, you know, you wouldn't isolate or whatever. It kind of opened my eyes a bit to people, you know. So I don't know if that's the answer, a comprehensive answer you wanted, but it's not for the faint-hearted, I'd say, you know. And it's like, don't do it in an abusive way. A lot of people are going out there and they're not able to interact. They kind of get emotionally, and we all get a bit emotional, but they get emotionally involved with the person they're talking to, and they might become, you know, abusive, use bad language. I try my best not to use bad language when I'm live, when I'm broadcasting or whatever as well. So, yeah, and give me a DM if you're thinking of doing something, you know, give me a DM on my platforms, Facebook or Twitter or whatever, and I'll try and help you.
Excellent. That's great. I'm it's nice of you to say that, to add that in. Okay, there are a few super chats for you, so I'll put those to you now. Mm-hmm. If you hold on. And okay. Let's see. Okay, there was a Dardy said, as an outsider, it seems tensions have reached an almost fever pitch in Ireland this past year. Does Philip see this new chapter of unrest and violence continuing? Or perhaps will we see further crackdowns like what happened in the UK after Southport?
Well, you're going to see both. I think this new government that were elected in 2024, when I say new, the same kind of people, but, you know, a new administration, let's call it, they kind of have a different approach to how they're dealing with it. They're coming out with stuff in the media where they're saying we're going to start doing deportations now, you know, and, you know, what that actually means is that they're going to have, 30 or 40 guys being deported once a week or whatever, when then at the same time in Dublin Airport, you'll see hundreds coming in, you know, and then going to DP centers, direct provision centers, claiming asylum. So they're kind of playing this media game a bit better than the previous administration. They are, in my opinion, they are being, from the side of the centers, they're coming down harder on the dissenters than the previous administration. They're coming down harder than the likes of me. They're weaponizing the criminal justice system against us. So now, as I said in a tweet today after the Australian thing in Bondi Beach, it's as night follows day. We here in Ireland, as you are in the UK, are going to suffer another terrorist attack. It's just by an immigrant or a foreigner or whatever who shouldn't be here. And it's definitely going to up the heat at the temperature as regards unrest. Nobody wants it to happen, but because they're bringing them in, and I was down in Leeds City West, that hotel, that the big massive hotel hub where the child was allegedly raped. I went back there last week or the week before, and like, you're just watching a Middle Eastern guy coming in with two big fat suitcases, and he's strolling in like a tourist into this hotel. And the place is a 4-star hotel, and he's been, the security guards are waving him through. They haven't a clue who it is. They wouldn't let me come in and film. I wanted to come in and do a report. They wouldn't let me do it. I said, I need an email. This guy just saunters in right past the site where this alleged rape had taken place. And I'm looking at this, and it's, this guy is coming into the country. Nobody has a clue anything about the guy. Then you have a group of four or five non-nationals, Arabic-looking guys, just sauntering outside the gate, looking to look where the nearest bus stop or train stop is, or Lewis stop. And they're like, who are these people? Like, well, so they're not curtailing all this immigration. It's still happening, regardless of the fact that a child has probably been just raped outside the gates of this place. So they just don't care. It's just, it doesn't, as you said, you mentioned the word, is it sociopathic? Like, it's like there's no empathy for what possibly is going to happen to the next family or families who will become victims of these people that they're bringing in that we don't know anything about. So it's definitely going to get worse here in Ireland as regards. There's going to be more violence and unrest as soon as that next incident occurs, and it's definitely going to occur. There was a Christian march about 2 months ago, I think it was, in Dublin, and I covered it on a live stream. And I was walking up right outside the Lord Mayor's house, actually Dawson Street, and I noticed a couple of lads, short jackets. They look like cops, right? They walk like cops, you know, so they wear cops. And you could see their sidearms. So the Irish police in general aren't armed, but you could see them carrying weapons. And I'm looking at this, and I'm saying, how are you, lads? So I went over, and I kind of said, how are you getting on? What's the story with this? Is a Catholic march. What's with the guns? You know, you're out in a Catholic march or whatever, you know. But in really, in effect, what they were doing was watching over for, in case of a jihadi attack on that Christian march, you know. And that's where we're at today in Ireland, and it's going to happen. As I said, they're not stopping the influx. We've signed up to the EU migration pact here in Ireland, where we used to have a right to opt out of migration. We had an option, us and Denmark. I think it was in the part of the Nice Agreement or something in 2003 that we had included ourselves in this opt out with Denmark. And then we've decided now to relinquish that opt-out and become part of this EU migration pact, where we have to take X amount of these so-called fake UGs or whatever you want to call them. And, it's frightening. It is frightening. And good question with that guy. And it's going to happen in the UK. The likes of Starmer has another couple of years left as well. What they do is then they're talking about measures. After this incident in City West, they're talking about bringing in measures to curtail migration. But it's just piecemeal stuff. It's really not going to be effective at all. Because I think in the UK, they were talking about stopping the boats and stuff like that, and then are bringing in some kind of measures. So when they bring in measures in the UK to curtail the boats coming over, the next port of call for them is going to be Ireland, and we're going to suffer because they can get into Ireland through Belfast and just saunter across our border. We have no border controls between Northern Ireland and ourselves. So that's going to expose us as well. The influx is still there. It's still come. They're still coming in their hordes, you know.
Yeah. I mean, the governments say this, that, and the other, but it's clear that they are ideologically in favour of not just mass immigration, but industrial immigration, like as many as can be bussed in each night as possible. It's that's what they want. And I think that what they say to the public is just whatever they feel they need to say to placate them and shut them up and just get them to accept even more. It's really amazing. I mean, the treachery just is all over our governments. And I don't understand, because they have to live in the same society as the rest of us. It's a weird thing. Like, what do they see? And I know people say, well, they live in gated communities and all that, but they don't really. I mean, they still have to see this stuff. And yet they somehow they're just completely blind to how it's inevitably going to play out.
Yeah, well, I mean, if you look at it, Colin, the ones that don't live in the gated communities and the ones that are living in these prestigious areas and gated communities, the ones that aren't anyway, what they're looking at is votes, like demographics. So what we're doing here in Ireland, and we've got more and more non-national standing in elections and stuff like that, and they're given the right to vote in local elections here in Ireland for some bizarre reason. You know, you just literally have to get off a plane and you can vote in our local elections in Ireland. So what's happening is that they see these, they won't face the consequences of, or the reality of the migrant crime and the effect on hospital waiting lists and the effect on school places and all that. That's all overridden because these politicians are going to get votes off these people, because why wouldn't they vote for them? They've been brought in and given everything, basically, the sun, moon and stars. Of course, they're going to vote for them. And these people know this. And that's why, you know, they feel like they go on about Agenda 2030 and the National Development Plan 2040 as if they're going to be in government in 2040, like there's no one else going to be in their place. You know, this is the, you know, there's the psychology that they have is that they're never going to be moved. And if they engineer things in a way where they're, the demographics are going to be in their favor, these new people that will tip the balance, you know, and then you'll have the, God help us, the idiots in Ireland that will listen to the piecemeal or these things to placate them every now and again. It's, oh yeah, you have to be a citizen now. You have to be in the country 5 years now, and you can't be on social welfare to become a citizen. Or, you know, we're going to deport these guys. As you say, this is all to placate the masses. And a lot of them, unfortunately, will look at that and say, oh yeah, but look, he's doing his best, you know, and they forget the fact that they actually created the problem. You know, this will be kind of all forgotten about. And say, oh, look at Jim O'Callaghan, Minister for Justice. Oh, look, he's trying to get them out. He's organising planes. Look, there's Dublin Airport. They'll show footage of Dublin Airport and a plane being loaded with 30-odd African lads, you know. And they'll fall for it, unfortunately. So, yeah, I don't know where it's going to take us, but...
Not pretty. No. Okay, there was a super chat. It's a donation from John G, so thank you for that. Dardy also said, thank you, Philip. You're doing important work. That's good. Much. And then Armchair Limerick Nationalist gave a generous super chat. You know him.
Yeah.
And he said, Merry Christmas, Phil and Woes. Does Phil think there is any cause for optimism in Irish politics in the future, or is it all doom and gloom?
Yeah, Armchair Limerick Nationalist is one of the greats. He's on a lot of the chats and streams in Ireland there, myself and Garrod Murphy and things. But is there optimism? Yes, there is. I'm sorry if I came across, you know, pessimistic and doom and gloom tonight, but from my experience, what I've witnessed is like, and Colin, you'll be very aware of this, is that the activity now from the alternative media has surged so much. I mean, you've seen, I did a couple of streams there with Nick Fuentes and what you call him, Piers Morgan, you know, I just can't stand that guy, but it was like the significance of that you have this radical right-wing young griper who's been, you know, shouting from the rooftops, and he's been saying lots of controversial things, and he stayed steadfast in his beliefs and in his attitudes and everything else. And all of a sudden now he's broken into the mainstream. And it's a sign, it kind of symbolizes it for us all, because it's something similar happened in Ireland. We are really making inroads. And it's like, for me, I'm out there and I'm doing content and everything else and people. But what signifies to me is when I go out on the street from my house, the amount of people I get coming up to me, like total strangers coming up to me. I get cars beeping at me on the road and lads giving me the thumbs up and, how are you, and all this kind of thing. Whereas, you know, as you noticed it too, 4 or 5 years ago, there was nobody making content. There was nobody getting we weren't really getting the message out there. And from that sense, it is. And you'd have to say your prayers and say, if we keep at it, keep doing what we're doing, and get it to a tipping point, Colin. Get it to a place, and hopefully you'll get this tsunami of awakening. This, you know, this is in an ideal world I'm talking about, but we're definitely getting there, where people are telling me their relatives that they used to have, you know, Christmas dinner last year, and they'd all be kind of wary about, you know, talking politics and talking about COVID and, you know, the flu jabs and the woo-hoo flu. And then this year, like, it's like, oh yeah, they're all saying it's all wrong and this is terrible and, you know, too many migrants and, you know, everywhere they look, and you know, there's a girl after being raped, and there's this and that, and they're not afraid anymore to speak out about it, you know. And I think you can get it's like a bit of a roller coaster. I don't know if you feel the same way. It's like there's those highs and lows in this game, whereas that you get this kind of surge a good feeling, and you meet a group of people, and then you come I can come home here. I can do a live stream sometimes and I get 30,000 people in there watching me live stream. And then I'm coming home to a one bed apartment and I'm sitting here looking out at the concrete jungle. And it's like, you're going from up here to down here. But when you're the likes of an old piece of turf like me that can go out and get, you know, that many people interested in what you're doing. And then there's loads more now doing it as well. We're definitely making a difference. It's definitely, but we have to make sure that in the future, if we do turn this thing around, that we put something in place, that we can't go back to what happened here to happen again. You know, let this detachment from reality, you know, the real world set in. We can't allow this to happen to our children, you know. We can't allow our country to be just demographically changed. So, and I think it can be reverse engineered, you know. It is possible, you know. The main thing to do is just stop social welfare and free stuff for these people coming in. And they'll soon start to leave. A lot of them will leave peacefully. A lot of them won't. And we'll have to deal with that when the time comes. But it is fixable. You know, we have to incentivize our immigrants to come back. You know, we've got... we're losing about 50,000 a year. Irish young people are leaving the country, you know, to go off for a better life. You know, will they find a better life? Hopefully they will, but hopefully we can create a country now in the future where, you know, they can come home with their kids and send their kids to a school that won't be telling them that, you know, it's okay to be a cat. We'll put a litter tray beside you in the school. Or it's okay to change into a boy or a girl or whatever. You know, and they want to be part of the country with their own people. And we can make it happen. You know, it's the will, it's the people, you get people with the will to do it, you know?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, I agree. And I think it's important to end on an optimistic message like that, because I think there is genuine reason for optimism, especially this year, this last 6 months. I think things have really picked up. And as you say, I absolutely noticed that our scene is much bigger than it was, say, 10 years ago, or even 5 years ago. So, yeah, there are more and more people getting involved, and there are more and more people seeing this stuff and chiming with it. So, yeah, I completely agree with you. Okay, let's end it there. I think this has been a good introduction to you and a good summary of the situation and of your background and how you got to all of this. So, thank you very much. It's been good. I'll be back in half an hour with the next interview. But in the meantime, Philip Dwyer, thank you for appearing on Millennial 2025.
Colin, thanks very much. It was a pleasure and an honour. Thanks very much.
Okay, thank you.
We hope you're enjoying Millennial. How about helping your tireless host? Sometimes the old ways are the best. To send Millennial Woes some special Yuletide cheer by post, you can use the P.O. Box. Address on screen now. Millennial amounts to 3 months of work for the vile vlogger. Please help him to keep the fire burning.